Did you know the Thomistic Institute offers two full-ride scholarships for the Master's in Theology at the Dominican House of Studies in Washington, D.C.? If you or someone you know has a passion for the Catholic intellectual tradition, especially the thought of St. Thomas Aquinas, this could be the opportunity of a lifetime. Visit ThomisticInstitute.org/MA-scholarships to learn more and apply today. This is a competitive scholarship. To be considered, please apply for the 2025 to 2026 academic year by January 28, 2025, the Feast of St. Thomas Aquinas. That's ThomisticInstitute.org/MA-scholarships.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
In 2004, then-Senator Hillary Clinton spoke at a fundraising event in San Francisco for then-Senator Barbara Boxer. She criticized tax cuts supported by the then-Bush administration and suggesting that they would be repealed if the Democrats took office that year, bluntly told her well-heeled audience, quote, "We're going to take things away from you on behalf of the common good," unquote. The blogosphere exploded, with many conservatives expressing indignation at what they identified as Clinton's rank Marxism. Common good, communist, right? You could almost run it together. More recently, a number of decidedly more conservative public intellectuals have championed things like common good constitutionalism, common good economics. Some more libertarian conservatives have responded to these calls in ways that echo the conservative response to Hillary Clinton by, for example, associating the idea of the common good with tyranny, arguing that it comes out of a political tradition deeply at odds with the American founding. At the same time, many have dismissed talk about the common good as vague as a vague slogan, a trope of usually Catholic political rhetoric that is largely empty of any real content. So the common good is seen alternately as Marxism, the revival of an ancient and un-American threat to liberty, and as an empty cliché. The idea of the common good is an ancient one. Indeed, it is a staple of Western political discourse. The first instance of its literal use is in Herodotus. Now, when I wrote this, I believed that to be true. I've now discovered an earlier use of the phrase common good in the Athenian-Spartan lyric poet of the 7th century BC, Tyrtaeus, who uses a Doric dialect version of the phrase common good, so mid-7th century BC. So it goes back even further than I had thought. And one can also find it in Thucydides, Plato, and especially Aristotle, for whom it plays a quite important role, a role that has made its way into specifically Catholic political thinking through its adoption by St. Thomas Aquinas. The common good is the name for the final cause of political association and political practice, a final cause being the end or purpose in Thomas and Aristotle's teleological understanding of political life. And yet here, too, there is controversy. Since at least the early 1960s, the Roman Catholic magisterium has employed a characterization of the common good that some Thomists have found scarcely recognizable. There is here a concern that somewhere in the mid-20th century Catholic social teaching, an integral part of Leo XIII's revival of the thought of Thomas Aquinas and engagement with modernity, jumped its tracks. It is this worry that I'd like to discuss with you this evening. I first want to discuss the formulation of the common good in contemporary Catholic social teaching. Then I want to look at what St. Thomas says about the common good, focusing especially on one key text, in fact, the only text where he specifically asks the question, or focuses on the concept of the common good. Then I want to make a few historical remarks about the relationship between St. Thomas's view and what we find in the magisterial statements that concern the nature of modern politics. My own view is that those statements, the magisterial statements, do in fact represent an authentic development of the Thomistic tradition and not a derailment. They have to do specifically with the Church's effort to come to terms with specific aspects of political life in the context of the modern state as its dominant political form. Okay, so first section. The now standard way of characterizing the common good in Catholic social teaching is most authoritatively stated in the Second Vatican Council's 1965 Pastoral Constitution for the Church in the Modern World, Gaudium et Spes, Articles 26, but more in more detail in Article 74. And if you have the handout, that first text, it says, indeed, the common good embraces the sum of those conditions of social life whereby men, families, and associations more adequately and readily may attain their own perfection. That's the formulation that I have in mind when I talk about the contemporary Catholic social teaching formulation of the common good. This formulation is very close to one given earlier in the document, in Article 26, as well as in the Council's Declaration on Religious Liberty, Dignitatis Humanae, which was passed the same year, I think it was the last document approved by the Council. Its presence in the Council documents is certainly a function of its presence in St. John the 23rd's social encyclicals, especially Mater et Magistra, which was published in 1961. It's also mentioned in Pacem in Terris, which came out in 1963. So that kind of pushes the question back if you say, where is that formulation to be found originally? It's in the Vatican II documents because it's in Mater et Magistra. And why was it in Mater et Magistra? Well, as we'll see, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, it originally shows up in the speeches, not encyclicals, but in speeches given by Pius XII in the 1950s. And so it appears already in textbooks on Catholic social teaching that were published in Europe in the 1950s and that were quoting speeches that had been given by Pius XII. But it enters authoritatively the magisterium in those documents of John the 23rd, and then it gets into the council documents, and then it gets in an important way into the catechism of the Catholic Church, which is the one stop people usually make if they want to have a kind of authoritative account of Catholic doctrine on just about everything. But that second quotation on the handout is from section 1907 of the Catechism of the Catholic Church. And it adds detail to the basic notion. So the basic notion, again, sum total of conditions according to which persons and groups can more fully and readily achieve their perfection. And then the details that are added in the catechism. First, the common good presupposes respect for the person as such. In the name of the common good, public authorities are bound to respect the fundamental and inalienable rights of the human person. So fundamental human rights are included there. Second, the common good requires the social well-being and development of the group itself. So development is another more detailed aspect of the common good. And then finally, in section 1909, finally, the common good requires peace, that is, stability and security of a just order. It presupposes that the authority should ensure by morally acceptable means the security of society and its members, and that includes personal and collective self-defense. So human rights, development, including economic and social development, and then things that we usually think of as core functions of government, law enforcement, national security, defense, those kinds of things are all a part of that conception of the common good. Now, as I say, that's the 1993 catechism. There have always been criticisms of this understanding of the common good. There are some people who've criticized it because they think it aims too low. So to say that the common good is a sum total of conditions, on the view of many people, is to suggest that the common good is merely an instrumental good, merely a means. Why is that a problem? Well, if we think of it as a way of talking about the final cause of society, right? The final cause is an end. Ordinarily, a means is for the sake of an end. So if the common good is an end, why would we want to describe it as a mere means or as a mere instrumental good? And so some people have thought by focusing on conditions, it makes the common good into a mere means and not a true final cause. I'm not myself sure that a set of conditions couldn't be a final cause of a certain sort, but this is a worry for a lot of people. There are other people who are worried about it for the opposite reason. They think it aims too high, because if you say that the common good is a sum total of conditions according to which person and groups can more fully and readily achieve their, and here sometimes the translations in the documents, you know, translators are all evil, They do things that are very bad. Sometimes they translate the Latin into words like, what is it, their own satisfaction or their own fulfillment or something like this. Well, okay, those are perfectly good things. But the Latin term there is perfectio. And the best translation of perfectio, in my view, is perfectio. And the second best translation is perfection. But for that reason, there are some people who've thought, I'm joking about translators. They're not really evil. They're just, sometimes they're misguided. They think they're doing you a favor, but really, okay. The safest thing is, of course, just to learn Latin, right? But perfectio seems to aim too high, right? If you say that these are conditions that promote perfection, well, wait a minute. We live in modern pluralistic societies where nobody agrees about perfection. So if this formulation is supposed to be appropriate for politics and the kind of societies we live in, some people say it sort of smuggles into the definition a specifically Catholic notion of perfection that many people wouldn't accept, right? Now, I'll talk a little bit about these things as we go along, but those are among the criticisms that people have sometimes made of this formulation. And they've thought, in particular, the first people who've criticized it, that this is a suggestion. It's not really Thomistic. It's a modern understanding of the common good that deviates from Thomas's view of it. Okay, so those are some of the worries. And as I say, you've got the basic formulation, and then you've got details that have been added to it that I just mentioned from that second quotation. Now, one could conclude from this that, and some people have concluded, if it talks about the conditions and then it lists these, that the conditions that are included in the common good are narrowly material, and that this suggests that prioritizing a kind of instrumentality of the common good. Here it's important to notice a feature of the formulation that's given in Article 74, the first one that I quoted, but not elsewhere in the council documents and that people often miss. The common good, it says, embraces or includes, and the Latin term there is complector, it embraces or concludes the sum total of conditions. But the formulation does not make these conditions exhaustive of it. This suggests a point first made, but rarely noted thereafter, by Oswald von Nell-Breuning, a great Jesuit theologian who was one of the writers of some of the encyclicals from the 1930s. For example, he was one of the drafters of Quadragesimo Anno, Pius XI. Oswald von Nell-Breuning, in his commentary on Gaudium et Spes, he argued that the formulation of the common good there should be understood as indicating an, as it were, lower level of the common good. But it's not intended to be a statement of the common good as such or in its completeness. He thought that this partial content was aimed at explaining specifically political society, but that the common good in its fullest sense transcended this. And that's a view that a number of other people have since taken, right? I mean, in one sense, the common good in its highest and fullest sense, right? Common, meaning shareable, good, meaning a final cause. What's the good that's most shareable, that's good for the most people, and that's the most good? Well, that's God. God is the common good of the whole universe, the separate common good of the whole universe. So clearly, this formulation is not intended to describe God. God is not a set of conditions. This set of conditions is intended to be social and political, obviously. So it explains an aspect of the common good, the political common good, but not the common good in the fullest possible sense of the term. There's another aspect of it that's interesting. Some people have suggested, again, that since it's this instrumental notion of it, that it's individualistic. But it's not individualistic, because it says it's the sum total of conditions according to which persons and groups can more fully and readily achieve their perfection. So it includes, it built into it, is the social nature of human beings and the importance of the family, but also other sorts of social groupings. With that, then, and with these kind of worries on the table, now I want to turn to what St. Thomas himself specifically says about the common good. Now, there's a couple of standard problems that face anyone hoping to understand St. Thomas's views about the common good. First, the point is frequently made that Aquinas nowhere gives a complete treatment of the common good. There's no question in the Summa de Bono Communi. There's no quaestione disputate de bono communi. There's nothing like that. What there is, the one place where Thomas expressly and only talks about the common good is one article of one question. Now, he mentions it in plenty of places, but there is no treatise on the common good that he wrote. So he mentions or alludes to it frequently, but given the seeming importance of the common good, it's odd that he doesn't offer a more systematic treatment. And many people have noticed this. Second, his discussion of it takes place in rather different contexts. That is, sometimes he's speaking in a very practical, even casuistical way about the common good, very practical cases, while in other texts, he's speaking in a far more speculative vein. In some places, when he talks about it as God, for example. The problem is that it's not altogether clear how these two types of treatment of the common good fit together for Aquinas. He doesn't do that himself. I want to focus first on one particular text, a very famous one, for understanding St. Thomas's political thought, and then a somewhat more unusual text in which he explicitly treats the common good. Now, the first text is from the Summa Theologiae, Prima Secundae, the first part of the second part, question 90, article 2. It's text number 3 on the handout. And it's in his famous discussion of the nature of law. Right, famously, Thomas defines law in question 90 of the Summa, and his definition of law is an ordinance of reason directed to the common good by those who have care of the community and promulgated. Very famous four-part definition of law that he gives there in question 90. But part of it is the common good, and so there's an article that discusses the common good. And here is an excerpt of the corpus of that article. Thomas says, as stated above in Article 1, the law belongs to that which is a principle of human acts, because it is their rule and measure. Now, as reason is a principle of human acts, so in reason itself there's something which is the principle in respect of all the rest. In reason itself there's a principle. Wherefore, to this principle chiefly and mainly law must needs be referred. Now, the first principle in practical matters, which are the object of practical reason, is the last end. Practical reason meaning reasoning about what we do, what choices we make. And the first principle there is the last end, the thing that we're ultimately aiming at. And the last end of human life is happiness or blessedness, as stated above in an earlier article. Consequently, the law must needs regard principally the relationship to blessedness. Moreover, since every part is ordained to the whole, as imperfect to perfect, so when there's a whole with parts, the parts are related to the whole insofar as they're imperfect, insofar as they're parts, they're imperfect, whereas the whole is perfect. And since one man is a part of the perfect community, meaning a complete community, the political community, the law must needs regard properly the relationship to communal happiness. Wherefore, the philosopher, in the above definition of legal matters, mentions both happiness and the body politic. The philosopher, of course, is Aristotle. For he says in Nicomachean Ethics 5:1 that we call those legal matters just which are adapted to produce and preserve happiness and its parts for the body politic, since the state is a perfect community, as he says in Politics 1:1. So that passage I just read, and you can look at it again because it's there on the handout, actually has two parts, and it's important to keep in mind that the overall context of that passage is Thomas's definition of law. Now, the first part of the passage identifies the common good in a very simple and straightforward sense as the good that is common to all human beings. That good is happiness or blessedness. So there is some sense in which the law aims at the happiness of persons. The second part of that passage adds the communal dimension. Since law is an element of the life of community, it aims not just at happiness, but at the happiness of a multitude of persons who make up that community. So the basic thrust of the discussion is that at aiming at the common good, the law aims at the happiness of human persons as members of a community. But the community Thomas mentions here is not community in a merely generic sense. He actually writes, citing Aristotle, perfect community and political community, communitas politica, which he also describes, again following Aristotle, as a perfect community, communitas perfecta, Now, by perfect, Thomas doesn't mean the best community ever. By perfect community, what he means is something more like complete. Perfect in that sense means complete. Political community is complete insofar as it contains within it all that is necessary for human beings to flourish. You don't have all of that in the family. It's not self-sustaining. You don't have all of that necessarily in local communities, which are too small to achieve the kind of division of labor that would be necessary to produce everything that people need to live a good life. You only achieve that when you reach the level of what Aristotle and Thomas both call political community. That's what's distinctive about political community. It's only in that kind of community that everything necessary for human flourishing is available. So the common good, a distinctive thing about political community as compared to the family, etc. And this is what Thomas means in, this is the fourth quotation, so on the second side of the passage. This is what Thomas means in the fourth quotation. The difference between the political community, and Thomas's term for that in Latin is civitas, which actually is city. He's literally translating Aristotle. Aristotle only talks about cities because that's what Greeks lived in, right? So he just translates Aristotle's Greek word polis as civitas, which is the Latin word for a city. So that's what a political community is for Thomas. Civitas is not simply a matter of a number of people, but there is a formal difference, a formal distinction to political community. The political community is a distinct kind of whole, and the distinction is to be found in its completeness. So the common good, understood as happiness, must also be seen not simply as happiness, but as the happiness of a civic multitude, of a multitude of human beings who live in a political community. This is a notion of happiness or flourishing appropriate to that kind of multitude, the totality of people who live in a political community. The difference between these two things is important. Thomas distinguishes between perfect happiness and imperfect happiness at the very beginning of his discussion of human action, at the start of the first part of the second part of the Summa. Perfect happiness for Thomas is the happiness of the blessed, who enjoy communion with God in heaven. And here he distinguishes also between the ultimate good for human beings understood objectively and in and of itself, what he calls the finis cuius, which is God, and that good subjectively in the human enjoyment of it, which he calls finis quo, and that's blessedness. So the ultimate good for a human being from the standpoint of a human being internally is happiness or blessedness, but the external object, which is that good, is God. So there's God, and then there's the human enjoyment of God. Those are both called the ultimate end, but one of them in an objective sense and one of them in a subjective sense. God is therefore the common good in an objective sense, and blessedness from the side of the creature is the common good in a subjective sense. But neither of these things can be achieved by a political community. Perfect happiness is supernatural and requires God's grace. The political community is concerned with the temporal common good. Thomas also describes what he calls imperfect happiness, which is essentially the sort of happiness that a human being can achieve via natural human powers. Put otherwise, for Thomas, imperfect happiness is basically what Aristotle said happiness was, which is a life of virtuous action and as much contemplation as you can get into that. This happiness is largely a function of the development of natural acquired virtues, the highest of which are the intellectual virtues. So perfect human happiness, imperfect human happiness, is the life of philosophical contemplation. Now again, and there's a kind of similarity here, the political community can't bring this about. The political community can't give you God. It can't make you blessed. It also can't give you wisdom and make you a philosopher. The moral virtues, which are connected to political life, are for Aristotle lower than the intellectual virtues. Here one can still ask whether the happiness to be found in the exercise of the acquired moral virtues is something that can be produced by law and government. But I want to come back to that point after discussing another aspect of the common good and another way of conceiving it. Recall the concerns about whether the Vatican II characterization of the common good really describes a final cause. The worry is that the common good, understood as an ensemble of conditions, is not a final cause, an end, or that for the sake of which, in the way that the common good is for Aquinas. One way that some Thomists have understood the common good as a final cause flows from some texts in which Thomas describes goods as causes and from the proper meaning of the phrase common good. We have a phrase here, common good. There's a noun and there is an adjective. So there's good and the adjective is common. We can look at how Thomas understands each of those terms as indicated by usage in various important texts. In other words, if you look at the way Thomas uses the word good and the way he uses the word common in lots of other things that he wrote, you can sort of make categories and think, well, when he puts those two words together, this is what he means, right? That would be a kind of definitional or linguistic way of understanding the meaning of the phrase. Here I want to register an initial reservation about this sort of approach, right? Just sort of saying bonum commune, common good. Bonum means this, commune means this, so this is what he means when he puts them together, right? I want to make an objection to that. While Thomas very frequently uses the phrase bonum commune in political context, he also uses a number of other phrases to describe the goal of political life. For example, bonum civitatis, which means the good of the city. Utilitas communis, meaning common utility. I think he actually uses that phrase more often than the phrase bonum commune. Bonum multitudinis, the good of the multitude. I think context suggests that these different phrases are in fact used interchangeably by Aquinas, so that a narrowly technical discussion of the one phrase, bonum commune, clarifies less than one might expect if that were the only phrase that Thomas used. Right, which is to say, I think just a kind of definitional understanding of that phrase is not that helpful, because he uses other phrases to mean pretty much the same thing. Here, I think we should follow Aristotle's famous injunction not to seek more precision than is admitted by the subject matter. In this case, the subject matter is politics, and the amount of metaphysical precision that can be achieved in politics is very, very limited. That said, taking the noun bonum first, Thomas famously repeats the Aristotelian classification of goods as noble goods, the bonum honestum, pleasant goods, goods of pleasure, bonum delectabile, or useful goods, bonum utile. Which type of good is the common good of the political community? Well, it hardly seems like a pleasant good. In fact, it seems less pleasant every day. It most certainly is a useful good, but is it not also, and perhaps most importantly, a noble good, a thing good in and of itself and not merely useful for individual persons? Aristotle famously describes the good of a city as more noble and godlike than the good of a single person, suggesting the high nobility of civic life. So while it is certainly useful, it also seems like it should be good for itself. Now, this aspect seems strengthened when we consider the adjective communis. There are three common senses in which Thomas uses this term. First, communis can indicate shared ownership. The community owns certain things commonly. The United States owns, for example, 11 aircraft carriers and 63 national parks. Sometimes, common goods of this kind are distributed in such a way as to become private property. Think, for example, of the Homestead Act, or the periodic auctioning of rights to use parts of the electromagnetic spectrum for broadcast purposes. Here it matters that the term good is usually plural, common goods. Now, clearly the political common good is not common in this way. It is not divisible. You can't, like, pick up a piece of the political common good and take it home with you. Here the term common indicates a shared state or character. But the state or characteristic exists not on its own, but in some particular person or thing. And there's a text on the handout number 5, which is where I'm drawing this from in Aquinas. I'm not going to read it, but you can look at it. Number 5 on the handout uses the example of the terms animal or man as naming a species. But elsewhere, Thomas uses the example of health. There is no such thing as health as a distinct unitary object that one might draw from. Like there's a big vat somewhere full of health and you ladle some out, right? I mean, that doesn't happen, right? Health is predicated of particular persons or things or actions. You are healthy. Brussels sprouts are healthy. We had a conversation about this at dinner. Your blood test was healthy. Jogging is healthy, right? Health used in various ways there, but predicated of particular persons and particular things. Is the political good a common? Is the political common good common in this way? Well, perhaps, but not insofar as it's a final cause. If we're talking about a final cause, then it's got to be common in a third causal sense, also described in passage 5. A thing common in this sense is numerically one, but extends to many effects. When Thomas is giving an image of this kind of a good, the one he usually gives is the sun. Right? It's one thing, but its effects radiate out and affect everyone else. This is the way the political common good is common, at least on one view. It's one thing, and its goodness is shared by the citizens and inhabitants of the political community. Should we think of the political common good as a causally common noble good? It helps first to ask what other kinds of things could be common in this way. The most important causally common good is, of course, God. And Thomas frequently says that God is the most common good there is, the final cause of final causes, perfect, perfective of everything in creation. And so God is the object of perfect happiness, as we saw earlier. But the subjective enjoyment of that good, the state of blessedness in a person, would be a good common by predication, right? There's no blessedness that you can just get a piece of. Blessedness is predicated of persons, right? The saints in heaven are blessed. The order of the universe is also said by Thomas to be a common good, and it would be causally common as well. The forces of gravity and other laws of nature that hold everything together, right? Although from the subjective side of the creature, its commonness would be otherwise. But what about the specifically political common good? First, it's worth saying what perhaps goes without saying, that the political community is not God, so it cannot be good in the way that God is good. It cannot perfect human beings in the way that God does. Its good is less common and less good, and so necessarily subordinate to the transcendent common good, that is God. Insofar as the common good of human beings is blessedness, the political common good is certainly not causal in any direct way. The political community does not save anyone's soul. Although it can be evaluated by reference to that common good, does it thwart the order of persons to God? Some political regimes do that. Does it support the ordering of persons towards God? How should it support that ordering? The answer to that question is related to particular facts or characteristics of the political community in question. What is beyond doubt is that the political community cannot itself order anyone to God. If we consider the specifically temporal common good, then the political common good would be the happiness of this present life, imperfect happiness, albeit one hopes on the way to perfect happiness, right? Ordered to perfect happiness, certainly not in conflict with perfect happiness. Sometimes the political common good has been conceived of as something like, quote, the virtuous life of the community, unquote. But it is not so easy to see what that kind of description means. Virtue is in some sense a common good, since having the virtues is good for all human beings, but that good would be good by predication and not causally common, right? There's no such thing as virtue that you can go grab a piece of and eat or something, right? You're virtuous or your actions are virtuous. Moreover, the political community and its various instrumentalities, like law, cannot simply make people good. Virtuous action is a function of one's own free, deliberate choices, as are the acts of true religion. For these reasons, I do not think we should characterize the specifically political common good as virtue, even though virtuous living is a common good and even a common good that benefits political communities, desirable to have. It behooves political communities to want its citizens to be virtuous and to do what can be done to promote virtuous living, but there are limits on the extent to which the law can do this. St. Thomas is very clear on this point. Law can remove obstacles to virtue, Thomas holds. It can help an individual develop virtue over time, but law cannot simply effect virtuous action. And laws that aim to stamp out vice can, in some circumstances, do more harm than good. Think about prohibition. So what can the political community do with respect to the happiness of its citizens? The political community can establish and maintain the conditions that allow individuals and groups to more fully and easily achieve their perfection. The sum total of those convictions is therefore a perfectly Thomistic way to understand the political common good. Indeed, Thomas describes the temporal common good as consisting of many things and emphasizes as constitutive elements of it justice and peace in the first part of the second part of the Summa, question 96, article 1, and in article 3. But what about the causal sense of the common good that I discussed? Can a sum total of conditions really be a final cause? I don't see why not. The establishment and maintenance of the conditions that allow persons to pursue authentic human flourishing is a very great good, and the absence of such conditions is a terrible evil. What we call failed states are political communities in which these conditions do not exist or have been radically reduced or damaged. What prospects do people have for temporal happiness if they live in Haiti at this moment, which has virtually no functioning government, or if they live in Sudan, or, frankly, if they live in large parts of Lebanon, which simply isn't controlled by a government, right? So the temporal common good requires those things. Those conditions are required. It's hard for people to be happy if they live in essentially a kind of a no man's land. The goodness of a well-functioning political community is indeed participated in by citizens for whom the conditions facilitate their own flourishing, although that flourishing is most centrally a product of their own choices. Their happiness is a product of their own choices. Is it a noble as distinct from a useful good? Well, certainly genuine human flourishing is good for itself, and so the unique value of a complete human community as the condition for flourishing is a noble good. It is, however, also a useful good. And many of the characteristic elements of modern political life are primarily useful goods, that is, specific legal and administrative procedures, right? Highways, bridges, airports, communications systems, all those things are useful goods. The worry about the useful aspect eclipsing the noble aspect is, I think, primarily a worry about liberalism as a political theory, evincing the neutrality of the state and its institutions towards the content of human flourishing. That's one way of understanding liberalism as a political theory, that the political community is neutral about perfection. But there is no need that the state be strictly neutral about this, although the empirical reality of pluralism is the most developed in the developed West means that the extent to which the political community may be oriented towards particular and specific conceptions of human flourishing will often, in fact, be limited. Now, one might ask just how helpful this account of the sense in which the common good is a final cause is. It is a way of understanding some metaphysical aspects of political life, but it does not determine much in a practical way. And this matters because politics is a practical thing. The merit of this way of thinking about the common good is the distinction it forces one to make between Thomas's view and a thoroughly reductionist or individualist view of the common good. John Rawls, for example, probably the greatest political philosopher in the English-speaking world of the last century, and maybe in the whole world in the last 100 years, John Rawls, for example, characterized political community as, quote, a cooperative venture for mutual advantage, unquote. Of course it is that. But if that's all it is, it becomes difficult to see why one would sacrifice one's own interests, much less risk one's life on its behalf. This view leaves one to wonder if there is really any common good as distinguished simply from a means to the satisfaction of private goods. That kind of account, common to liberal political philosophy, but, I hasten to add, not necessarily to liberal political institutions, which are not the same thing, is, however, a salutary provocation. It forces us to reflect again on the sense in which the common good of the political community can be a final cause, a goal, as distinct from simply a means. Thinking about this issue requires us to add a final point about Thomas's view. It is a not uncommon mistake for people to identify the common good with society and the private or particular good with the individual. When we get the question of the relationship between society and the individual and the familiar discussion of trade-offs between the interests of individuals and that of society, right? So individual good versus the good of society, right? This is not an issue about the common good as Thomas understands it. The common good is not the same thing as the community. The common good is the end of the community. It is the purpose of the community. It is not a collective being that faces the individual. It is the good common to individuals. So the common good is not to be understood as in tension with the private good of individuals so much as a part of it. The common good is common, and private goods are at least less common, perhaps not common at all. The political common good, then, is a good that is perfective of all citizens and inhabitants of the community. It is for them. Yet, insofar as it is a final cause, one might say that they are for it. But how can this be? If it exists for persons, why would persons give up any of their private goods for its sake? For the same reason, persons sacrifice any of some things they regard as good for other goods, right? In other words, they sacrifice some goods for the sake of other goods, including the good of well-being, the well-being of other persons. Think here of Aristotle and Thomas's understanding of friendship. Friendship is a good for persons as well. It is perfective for persons, so one wants friendship, precisely as a part of one's own good. But friendship directs one to the good of the friend for the sake of the friend. Without this, there is no friendship. In willing the good of the friend, therefore, one wills one's own good. So it is with the common good of the community. In willing the political common good and acting on that will, one wills one's own good, since it is common. Now, this does not eliminate the loss that comes with sacrifice, or the tensions that can arise with respect to different goods. These losses and tensions are unavoidable aspects of the limited human condition and an indication of the limits of political life, as necessary and noble as it can be. The political common good is not the most common good, and it is not the best good. And these limits then bring me to the third and final part of my remarks. I have argued that the formulation about the common good that we find in the council documents and subsequent magisterial statements is consistent with the Thomistic view of the common good. Still, one might wonder about those more recent statements since they seem to focus exclusively on conditions, on what one might call the useful or instrumental objects of political life, and less on the connection between the political community and human flourishing, its most noble aspect. That is a fair question. And so I want to say something about it. If one looks at the legislative history of Gaudium et Spes, the pastoral constitution of the church in the modern world, there is something interesting here. There were two preliminary drafts of that document in the published acts of the council. These drafts were distributed on the floor of the council for the council fathers to read and then offer amendments to and ultimately to vote on. So that, you know, the text that we have was a text that took, in fact, years to develop, and there were earlier drafts that were considered. So there are two preliminary drafts of that document published in the Acts of the Council. The first gives an account of the common good that cites a number of texts from St. Thomas, as well as some texts from Pius XII. A second revised text has something close to what was in the final document with the formulation that we began with. Now, clearly, that second version was preferred because the formulation of the common good there was already a formulation that had been used by John the 23rd in Mater et Magistra and Pacem in Terris, the most recent social encyclicals. So those encyclicals were the state of the art at the time that the council document on social things was produced. But that just pushes the question back a bit. Why was that formulation in those encyclicals of John? The short answer is that it was already, in a sense, current because it had been employed by John's predecessor, Pius XII. In his 1942 Christmas radio message, Pius XII said of the state, quote, "All of the political and economic activity of the state is directed to the permanent realization of the common good, which is to say, of the external conditions that are necessary to all the citizens for the development of their qualities and functions, of their material, intellectual, and religious life." One can find very similar formulations in texts from both Piuses in quotations 6 and 7 on the handout, so I give the quotations, I won't read them, but they're there. The quotation from Pius XII's 1939 encyclical, Summi Pontificatus, is particularly important given his description of political society as, quote, "a kind of means, quasi-instrumentum, or a kind of instrument," unquote. And this phrase that he uses, I'll come back to in a second. How it came to be a teaching of Pius XII can be explained in two related ways, one very specific and personal, and one more broad and theoretical. The very specific and personal source of this account of the common good was, I believe, Gustav Gundlach, who lived from 1892 to 1963. Gundlach was a Jesuit social theorist who advised both Pius XI and Pius XII. Gundlach wrote speeches and helped draft other documents for Pius XII while teaching at the Gregorian University in Rome. He also had a hand in the first draft of John XXIII's encyclical Mater et Magistra, although others took over work on that document and changed quite a bit of it, and Gundlach died shortly thereafter. The more general and theoretical way that this view came into papal teaching under especially Pius XII concerns Pius's focus, taken up by John and later spectacularly by St. John Paul II, on the need in politics to defend the dignity of the human person, especially in the context of political modernity, which is dominated by the political form of the modern state, and in the historical era of the rise of totalitarian ideological movements. This second point is, I trust, well understood. I need to say a little bit more about the first. When I refer to the modern state, I mean the sort of political community that is now universal, and the classical account of which was given in one way by Thomas Hobbes and in another by Max Weber. Weber famously described the state as a political form that exercises a monopoly on the legitimate use of coercive force in a geographically defined territory. Weber also discussed the centrality of modern states of bureaucratic institutions, that is, formal, rule-governed structures administered by officials with defined powers and responsibilities, with clearly maintained records and procedures. This form grew out of the absolutist monarchies of early modernity, mainly out of the need to administer large, diverse territories and to finance and fight very expensive modern wars against other states. The political form of the modern state is quite different from the polis described by Aristotle, from medieval kingdoms, or from Renaissance city-states. Modern states are large, impersonal, and possess a concentrated physical power enabled by modern science and technology that make them capable of extraordinary things, both good and bad. One of the extraordinary good things was flying to the moon. I mean, that could not have been done except by a state that was able to marshal the kinds of technological and financial resources that the United States was able to marshal in the 1960s. But among the bad things is an ability to employ coercive force, even repressive force, in a way more sweeping than any ancient king or tyrant could have dreamed of: the repression of modern totalitarian states. That makes the state potentially a great threat to everything else, to human persons, local communities, and to the church. Alas, it has not just been a threat, but all too often in modern times a reality. And it still is, for example, in China. While the characterization of the modern state in terms of its institutions and practices is important and reveals important elements of modern political life, it is also important to take account of its theoretical self-understanding. The great philosopher of the modern state was Thomas Hobbes, whose 1651 book Leviathan described the state as a political community brought into being and empowered exclusively by human will. An artificial construction modeled on a thoroughly materialist and mechanistic conception of human beings. Much of that account was carried on by later political philosophers with various modifications through Locke and Rousseau, right up to John Rawls, who I mentioned earlier. Its most important feature is the severance of political life from the natural moral law, and therefore from the eternal law, that is, from any sense of the world and human affairs as integral to God's providential government of the cosmos through creation and then redemption. While we needn't accept this view of the state, it is important to recognize how much it has influenced the political practice and theory of modern politics. Gustav Gundlach was heir to a tradition of Jesuit social thought that was greatly concerned with these problems. The Jesuit tradition was also Thomistic, driven by the injunction of Leo XIII to recover the thought of Aquinas and apply it to contemporary social and political affairs. Of course, Leo was especially concerned with the political turmoil that engulfed Europe, beginning with the French Revolution and continuing with the revolutions of 1848 and the violent, often anti-clerical nationalist movements like the Italian Risorgimento and the German Kulturkampf. A pivotal figure in that tradition was Luigi Taparelli d'Azeglio, who lived from 1793 to 1862, who was one of the principal figures in the early stages of the Thomistic revival and probably converted young Gioacchino Pecci, the future Leo XIII, to his Thomistic philosophical commitments. Taparelli's sprawling treatise on natural law, written during the fraught middle of the 19th century, contains the seeds of the formulation of the common good that eventually found its way into the writings of Pius XII. It was developed by German Jesuits working at the Jesuit Studium at Maria Lach in Rhineland. That community was forced out of Germany during the Kulturkampf, but had already devoted themselves especially to understanding the implications of modern political institutions and practices from a Thomistic perspective. They were especially concerned with the defense of the freedom of the church, the dignity of the human person, and the limitation of the power of the modern state. For our purposes, the most consequential of these figures was Victor Catherine, who lived from 1845 to 1931, a prolific writer on moral, social, and political questions in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Number 8 on your handout is a quote from Catherine's treatise on moral philosophy, first published in 1893, and that treatise ran to 21 editions, the last appearing in 1959, the second year of St. John XXIII's pontificate. Catherine's characterization of the political common good is quoted authoritatively in Heinrich Pesch's treatise on political economy, which was so influential on Pius XI's 1931 encyclical Quadragesimo Anno, drafted by another Jesuit social thinker, Oswald von Nell-Breuning. It was for the purpose of continuing Pesch's work that his Jesuit superior sent Gustav Gundlach to study economics and sociology in 1924. That is the backstory of the formulation of the common good in Gaudium et Spes. The Vatican II account of the common good is not, I tried to argue, only consistent with the Thomistic understanding, but in fact a product of the Neo-Thomist revival. It is an attempt to apply St. Thomas's political ideas to the conditions of modern times, that is, to the political world dominated by the modern state, a powerful, if often inept, legal bureaucratic entity that also presents itself as the product of human will and riven by social pluralism. The Vatican II theory is intended to defend the dignity of the human person and the freedom of the church, and to limit and discipline the power of the modern state. While the common good can still be seen as a final cause, the state, charged with promoting and defending it, cannot. The state is for the common good of persons. Those goals are, I would submit, more important now than ever. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.